John Bachman, who pierces people's face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my rock?
Now the N is for knots, oh no, my bones are sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish I didn't get.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Mukitas, who plays a sour note. W is Tiasis, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Wednesday, October 5th, 2011. Israeli military detains a number of Palestinians and demolishes water cisterns in the West Bank. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. On Wednesday, Israeli army personnel kidnapped two Palestinian youth from Kablan and Awarta village in the southern part of the West Bank city of Nablus after breaking into their houses. Palestinian security sources reported that the army seized Haytham Azhar, 22, from Kablan village and Jaber Awad, 21, from Awarta village. In addition, Israeli military forces, accompanied by a number of vehicles, invaded the village of Aktaba in the northeastern part of the West Bank city of Tulkarim and patrolled its streets. Eyewitnesses stated that the forces moved from one street to another, stopping at different places as though considering a permanent base in the area. For the second time in 3 days, Israeli military vehicles and forces have invaded the village of Aktaba without making arrests. This time, however, was preceded by imposition of tight measures at the military checkpoints in Tulkarm. An Israeli settler hit a Palestinian youth with his car on Wednesday morning near the West Bank city of Nablus and fled the scene. Palestinian local sources said that the youth, Nasser Abul Kabash, 20, was trying to cross the main street near the village when the settler driving a white car struck him and continued without stopping. This is the second time in the past 24 hours that settlers have run over Palestinian residents. Two sisters were struck and injured in Hawara village, south of Nablus, on Tuesday morning. On Wednesday morning, the Israeli army kidnapped five residents from Kfar Kaddoum village in the eastern part of the West Bank city of Qalqilia, moving them to an unknown destination. Eyewitnesses stated that the military invaded the village, broke into several houses, and kidnapped five residents. Palestinian sources said that during this September, Israeli army kidnapped a number of the village youth in attempts to suppress the weekly protest organized by popular committees against closing the main entrance of the village. The entrance has been closed for 9 years. On Wednesday, Israeli military bulldozers destroyed two water cisterns and some rooms built by the farmers in their farmlands in Kufrat Diq village near the West Bank city of Salfit. At least 10 Israeli vehicles escorted by two military units carried out the destruction work. The rooms are made of bricks and are used by the farmers during the olive harvesting season, which started in some of the West Bank areas. The water cisterns were built as part of a project to support Palestinian farmers by the Palestinian Agricultural Relief Committee's park and funded by the Dutch government, in which 20 water cisterns were built in September. That was just some of the news from Palestine today. For more updates, please visit our website www.imemc.org. Thank you for joining us from Occupied Bethlehem. This report has been brought to you by Hossam Kassis and me, George Rushman.
Kirkuk, Iraq, last week. Forbes News is reporting the death of a U.S. soldier from an indirect fire mortar attack in an undisclosed location in northern Iraq, according to U.S. military officials. The Pentagon confirms he is a military policeman from Georgia. Afghanistan, Monday. NATO is reporting the death of a soldier of unspecified nationality from a non-hostile related incident in an undisclosed location in southern Afghanistan. Afghanistan, yesterday. NATO is reporting the death of a soldier of unspecified nationality from an IED attack in an undisclosed location in eastern Afghanistan. Afghanistan, Monday. An Afghan soldier fired a rocket-propelled grenade at an outpost manned by French and Afghan troops in Kapisa province north of Kabul on Monday but caused no casualties, according to the French military. This sort of thing just keeps happening, just like it did to the Soviet Army in the 1980s. Kandahar, Afghanistan, today. At least 8 civilians and 1 policeman were killed, and about 25 people were wounded when insurgents attacked a police patrol on the outskirts of Kandahar City, according to a spokesman for the provincial governor. Afghanistan, today. Afghan President Karzai barely escaped being next in a long line of Afghan puppet government officials taken out by insurgents. Government security forces claim to have broken up a 6-man team associated with both Al-Qaeda and a Haqqani network focused on taking Karzai out. This is while the Afghan government is accusing Pakistan of helping the Haqqani network carry out almost all their important assassinations and bombings. Pakistan, yesterday. Suspected Sunni extremists executed 12 Shiite Muslims after ordering them off a bus and lining them up Tuesday in southwestern Pakistan, ramping up a campaign of sectarian violence that has exposed Islamabad's inability to protect minorities. Baghdad, Iraq, Sunday. At least 6 people were killed in 2 back-to-back roadside bomb blasts near Baghdad, according to China's Xinhua News Agency. 2 members of the Sunni paramilitary Awakening Council were killed when their car detonated a roadside bomb in the Al-Dubai area, some 50 kilometers north of Baghdad. A second roadside bomb exploded minutes later when another vehicle carrying militiamen rushed to the scene. It killed 4 other people, said a police official requesting anonymity. The Awakening were Sawa fighters, or former insurgents, who sided with the U.S. beginning in 2007 and have been regarded as traitors by insurgents ever since. Iraq, today. The Iraqi puppet government has announced that they want U.S. traitors to stay in Iraq past the end of the year, a deadline for withdrawal of U.S. forces. They also, however, are refusing to provide U.S. forces with immunity from criminal prosecution for war crimes in Iraqi courts. Unknown if the U.S. is willing to deploy troops to an area where they will face criminal prosecution. If any U.S. forces do stay, Muqtada al-Sadr's Mahdi army promises all-out war against them, along with a number of other insurgent groups that have been patiently waiting for them to leave.
Mr. Barack Obama, haven't we had enough of this? Tomorrow is the 10th anniversary of the start of the war in occupied Afghanistan, and little has changed there or in Iraq in years of fruitless war. Now is the time to pull the plug, bring all the troops home today.
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Occupy Wall Street is a protest encampment in New York City that has occupied a park near the Stock Exchange on Wall Street since the 17th of September. They have braved thunder, rain, and police brutality for weeks to drive home the message that Wall Street's domination of American politics at the expense of Main Street has to end. On Saturday, the 1st of October, the Occupy Wall Street protesters, at least 9,000 strong and reported by some as up to 14,000 strong, marched on and blocked the Brooklyn Bridge. New York cops once again broke out the orange freedom fence netting and mass arrested 700 people. Protesters occupied half of the bridge at least, and the cops shut down all of it in response, entirely blocking the Brooklyn Bridge.
Occupy Wall Street, Brooklyn Bridge, the protesters have taken it over, and now they deal with the impossible task of arresting thousands of people on the Brooklyn Bridge. Live reporting, we are engaged. They're kicking the press out. They're kicking the press out not to get the brutality of what's happening. Let them document!
A week earlier, on Saturday the 24th of September, they had used the orange nets to arrest 100 people and torture 5 women with pepper spray, but the protests kept growing. Nearly a week before that, on the 20th of September, they arrested 5 people and nearly killed a man with asthma by sitting on his chest. But the protests kept growing. Now there are reports that the NYPD may have actually directed marchers onto the Brooklyn Bridge in the first place before turning around and mass arresting 700 people, using the bridge itself as a holding pen by stringing the orange nets across the roads at both ends backed by police lines. If people were arrested for following police orders, that's yet another scandal for the NYPD and more fuel poured on protesters' already blazing motivation. Hey, NYPD, want to go for 100,000 protesters? Just keep it up.
Is there big revolution in this town?
Get up, get down. There's revolution in this town. Get up, get down. There's revolution in this town. Get up, get down. There's revolution.
As the Occupy Wall Street protest encampment entered its third week in Lower Manhattan, activists there launched a march over the Brooklyn Bridge on October 1st that resulted in the arrest of 700 people. Although the New York City police say they warned protesters over bullhorns that marching onto the iconic bridge's roadway was illegal, eyewitnesses accused police of leading hundreds into the car lanes before moving in to make mass arrests. Whatever the original intent, the police crackdown on the Occupy Wall Street activists, including the documented earlier unprovoked pepper spraying of protesters, has given the action widespread and mostly positive publicity across the nation and the world. By skillfully employing social media and circulating viral video of police abuse, the Occupy Wall Street model of protest encampments has spread to more than a dozen cities across the U.S. Occupations of public spaces have been organized in Los Angeles, Chicago, Boston, and other cities large and small, with the number growing every day. Although activists gathered in New York and other cities don't as yet have a comprehensive list of demands, those involved clearly have a common set of beliefs focused on resistance to unbridled corporate greed, facilitated by a corrupt political system linked to a call for accountability. Your reporter visited the protest site at Zuccotti Park in Lower Manhattan's financial district on October 1st and interviewed one of the Occupy Wall Street organizers, who goes by the name of Joe Hill, just before he and hundreds of others were arrested on the Brooklyn Bridge. Here he talks about the origins and future direction of what appears to many observers to be the foundation of a new national economic and social justice movement.
About a month ago, some of us got together and formed the New York City General Assembly and began to make groundwork and planning for the hopes that we would be able to claim a space in the financial district to raise a critique about what's happened in the economic system and to build a movement to fight back against the consolidation of wealth.
What did you envision back before September 17th and the beginning of the occupation, and compare that maybe to what actually has happened in the couple of weeks since?
Well, I've been hoping for 20 years now, but most recently with the last crash, that people would begin to fight back. But frankly, I thought that we wouldn't last more than a couple days and that we would be cleared out by Monday and that there wouldn't be enough people to maintain the strength of this space. And so I didn't expect that we would last more than a couple days, but hope that we would.
So what's been your impression of how this has taken off, not just here in New York City, but there are other groups forming around the country with similar occupations happening or being planned?
My impression is that this is the most exciting moment in my adult life. I've been working for social justice in various capacities for 20 years and have never seen the excitement and enthusiasm that's taking place right here and across the country. And I think a lot of that is due to the method of organizing that's being employed here, which is, you know, not having slogans and cookie-cutter approaches that can be quickly co-opted by anybody, be it the Democratic Party or a trade union, but rather it's individuals and people who may or may not be part of groups coming together to find common solutions and common ground, which has really struck a nerve with people who, you know, don't have other avenues of protest. And that the process itself is exciting. Of course, it's based on things that have happened in other countries, including Spain, Greece, and North Africa, you know, and people are really serious about this. This is not a ragtag group of people who don't know what they're doing. Most people have read quite a bit about the other movements and are actually employing those tactics and strategies so that we can grow and build the kind of movement it's going to take the country back.
As you were planning this before September 17th and the occupation began, were you consciously trying to formulate something here that would go beyond a simple protest and actually be the seeds for the start of a movement?
Absolutely. Some of the feedback I got from people that I invited to this is, why are you doing it on a Saturday? And I would explain that this isn't a demonstration, this is an occupation. And most people move into new houses on a Saturday, and so that it's a day that we could begin the movement, but wasn't going to be a one-day protest. The days of being able to effectively have a one-day symbolic protest and affect policy are in our past. What we need to do is actually have a sustained resistance.
Where do you see this thing heading in the next few weeks to long-range future? You know, people talk about camping out here in the middle of January when it's, you know, below zero or 20 degrees and a lot of wind and snow. What do you see happening?
I think the commitment and the conditions that most of these people are facing by being unemployed, by coming out with massive student debt, will keep this thing going for the long haul. I'm not sure exactly what sort of shape it will take, but I certainly think that what started here is not going to stop anytime soon. I hope that the encampment can stay throughout the winter, but the ultimate goal isn't just to hold and occupy this space. The goal is to create a platform by which we can begin a resistance against the 1%, and that's already happened, and the contacts and connections that people have been making in this square will last beyond this square, and the tactics and things that we're all learning from each other are things that will help us get through winter, and certainly will be around in the spring and summer, and really, frankly, if you talk to people here, they're saying it's as long as it takes, and I believe that. I believe that that's the overwhelming sentiment of people here.
Beyond the occupation and the symbolism it represents and the hope it represents for people who want to take the tact of resistance, what concretely do you want to have come out of this thing in terms of, I don't know, a change in policy or presenting policy alternatives and then making demands to invoke them?
I mean, I don't think that change in policy is in the cards in our with the way that our government is structured, be it money in politics or be it the two parties that are acting for the same class of people, that we're not thinking, I'm not, and many people here aren't thinking about it as any sort of short-term policy fix. So we don't want to get behind the healthcare for all banner that turns into healthcare for everybody from 19 to 26 years old. We don't want to get behind some, you know, employee free choice act that ends up people don't get collective bargaining and then hear great speeches for some great candidate. That's not where it's going. In terms of the concrete things that could happen, those are happening. People are learning how to feed each other. People are learning how to take care of each other. And people are learning how to share skills. And frankly, creating a new democracy and a new economy in a small square in the heart of the old economy. And so when we get a new economic system in this country, I don't know. But it seems to be happening faster than I thought it would have happened. If you look at mainstream labor unions endorsing this action and people coming in off the street, this thing is growing quicker than any of us had hoped. And we take a long vision for how the change can happen. And it's happening one person at a time.
That was Joe Hill, an organizer with the Occupy Wall Street protest encampment. Find links to more information on this new economic justice movement by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.
Greetings, institutions of the media. We are anonymous. The events transpiring within Wall Street have caught our eye. It seems that the government and federal agencies enjoy enforcing the law a little too much. They institute unjust laws as mindless automatons, blindly following orders with soulless precision. We witness the government enforcing the laws that punish the 99%, while allowing the 1% to escape justice, unharmed, for their crimes against the people. We have observed this same government failing to enforce even the minimal legal restraints of Wall Street's abuses. This government, who has willingly ignored the greed at Wall Street, has even bailed out the perpetrators that have caused our crisis. We will not stand by and watch the system take over our way of life. We the people shall stand against the government's inaction. We the people will not be witnesses to your corruption and ill-gotten profits. We will not labor for your leisure. We will not assist you in any way. This is why we choose to declare our war against the New York Stock Exchange. We can no longer stay silent, as the population is being taken advantage of for the sake of profit. We will show the world that we are true to our word. On October 10th, NYSE shall be erased from the internet. On October 10th, expect a day that shall never, ever, be forgot. Vox Populi, Vox Anon. The voice of the people is the voice of Anonymous. We are Legion. We are the 99%. We do not forgive. We do not forget. Wall Street, expect us.
Here is the latest from Occupy Wall Street. Earlier today, this announcement was posted on the Occupy Wall Street website. On the 5th of October, 2011, at 3 p.m. in the afternoon, the residents of Liberty Square will gather to join their union brothers and sisters in solidarity and march. At 4:30 in the afternoon, the 99% will march in solidarity with Occupy Wall Street from Foley Square to the Financial District, where their pensions have disappeared to, where their health has disappeared to. Together we will protest this great injustice. Reports in the mainstream press, which went out of their way to ignore Occupy Wall Street until Saturday's mass arrest of 700 protesters, indicated this could be the largest march yet, with the unions mobilizing their rank and file and tens of thousands expected to march. The 99% means everyone except the 1% of the public that holds a majority of the wealth in the U.S. Of October, the third day of Occupy DC in solidarity with Occupy Wall Street. A small detachment marched from the campsite to the Bank of America at 17th and I Streets, and Bank of America closed themselves down. At a raiding party coming out from Occupy DC going to Bank of America. Occupy DC rolling in on Bank of America.
When the economy recessed, 99% of American citizens suffered. Bank of America executives are among the 1% that did not. We are occupying D.C. to raise awareness regarding unequal representation in the United States government, and also in solidarity with the Wall Street occupation. Come and join us at McPherson Square. We will be staying there indefinitely. We are occupying D.C. to raise awareness regarding unequal representation in government. On October 6th, we will be meeting up with the October 2011 protest to force approaching 1,000 people.
That was all it took to close the 17th and I Street branch of the Bank of America. 2 days earlier, on Saturday the 1st of October, 100 people had shown up at Occupy DC, enough to break into 16 crews of six, leaving four to guard the campsite and send everybody else to shut down 16 different branches of the same bank. It hasn't always been fun and games for the people of Occupy DC, who have held their ground through cold and rain. Like good soldiers, they've not been deterred by weather, not been deterred by problems with neighbors, and have been holding firm. Here's what one of the occupants of Occupy DC's campsite in the surrounding area had to say on the 3rd of October at about 9 a.m. about what it had been like sleeping the previous night.
Okay, so you spent the night here as part of Occupy DC. What have things been like at night?
Cold, fairly wet, but comfortable enough to get a good night's sleep.
Any problems with the cops or anything?
There was a security officer in front of Potbelly's who made us leave. And so we moved in front of a restaurant and a dry cleaner's. And then we got kicked out of there at around 5 a.m., 6 a.m.
So how can they kick you off the public sidewalk? From what I heard, the cops would complain about sleeping in the park, but not on the sidewalk.
Well, we were blocking the business owner's entrances, so...
And he was using it at that hour?
Excuse me?
He was using it at that hour?
I don't know.
Dude,
I was so tired, I didn't even have time to think. I was like, I need to
be quick. The area right in front of Starbucks and Potbelly was private property, and that we weren't allowed to.
He might have been lying, too.
I think that's very possible. Our legal advisor informed us that sleeping in front of basically any storefront or entrance is totally kosher, as opposed to sleeping in the park.
Then why did we leave?
Because the guy was going to keep insisting that we leave until we did, and it would have been annoying trying to sleep.
That sounds like he needs to be marched on at some point.
Yeah. I really hope to see in the coming days and weeks is to get more people who come and camp out with us. It would be great, ideally, to see something comparable to what they have on Wall Street, because they have a park just full of people, like a couple hundred people sleeping out, and it's not as easy to just tell those people to pick up and move because there's a whole community there.
I mean, look what happened in New York. They may have mass arrested 700 people, but it was out of 9,000 to 14,000. The statistical odds of being arrested there were less than the odds of being arrested at the 2010 spring IMF protest that had 8 arrests out of 60 people.
That's an excellent point. No matter how many people they arrest, people are going to keep coming out, and they can't hold those people forever. They have to release them. And if anything, it's just giving more fuel to the cause, because every time you hear about these mass arrests, it just creates outrage, and it just kind of brings more people to our side.
That's what's been happening.
So if anything, I think the arrests are good for the cause, because as soon as these mass arrests happen, the word gets out on Facebook, Twitter, and everything, and it incites more people to come join the cause.
All right.
So I hope someone comes and tries to arrest me, because it might make a nice little media story.
So your message to the cops is go ahead, make my day.
Exactly.
Go ahead, please. Make my day.
Reverend Anthony Evans stopped by the Occupy DC action at Bank of America, and here's what he had to say about his church's upcoming campaign against BB&T Bank for discriminating against African Americans.
Reverend Anthony Evans talking here about BB&T Bank.
I have warned BB&T Bank that we are coming at them. BB&T, We will get you. We'll come in at you.
And what's BB&T been doing?
Well, they've been exploiting the African-American community. They don't give us loans. They don't give us small loans. They don't do any business in the African-American community. They only take the upper tier of the black folks, and the lower tier of the black folks, they didn't even want the blank bank here. But we're coming at you because you're discriminating against African-Americans and black people. So the black church is coming at you.
Woo! BB&T, Bank of America, K Street, Wall Street, it's about time you stop corrupting American politics. It's about time we put Main Street in command and Wall Street on the bottom. This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, covering Occupy DC in solidarity with Occupy Wall Street up in New York City. Of October, Occupy DC marched on Koch Industries, home of the notorious Koch brothers, right-wing billionaire brothers who fund everything from Miss Michelle Rhee's union-busting anti-teacher organization to the Tea Party.
Koch Industries, the largest privately held corporation in the world. It is a sort of clearinghouse for extractive industries. They do petroleum, petrochemicals, natural gas, logging. If you want to ruin the earth, consider investing in Koch Industries. Then they use that money to serve the community by investing ungodly amounts of money, at least $50 million in Republican politicians. They fund wonderful groups like Americans for Prosperity, Freedom Works, a lot of that. Lovely folks find party. Generally speaking, they would love to shred the social contract, abolish all environmental regulation, and do anything that basically stands in the way of their global domination.
Don't forget the unions.
Yes, they sure do love busting unions. So,
rolling in on 614th Street, the Koch Brothers lobbying office. Right there. Here it is! Rolling in!
This is what democracy looks like!
That's the one.
We're on it! Make sure pedestrians can get through. That's it!
This is what democracy looks like!
What does democracy look like?
This is what democracy looks like!
Kemper, Navigo, and Energy Interests, the second largest privately held company in the United States. That's two men! How many votes do two men get?
Two!
Right! How much influence does the Koch brothers have in 2011?
Too much!
You're right! Too much influence! The Koch brothers
like cocaine.
Played a crucial role in organizing the Tea Party movement. Their billions have done much damage to our democracy in the last 2 years. And before that,
Let's get some more people to read off
the crack of American politics. Just say no.
Keep your billions out of our ballot box.
Keep your billions
out of our ballot box.
Okay, I'm going to read through the list. Pledging to abolish Social Security, the Federal Reserve System, welfare, minimum wage laws, and federal agencies. Improper payments to win business in Africa, India, and the Middle East, and has sold millions of dollars of petrochemical equipment to Iran. Also rigged prices with competitors, lied to regulators, and repeatedly run afoul of environmental regulations. Business as usual. We have had 5 criminal convictions since 1999, but it should be more than that.
Anybody gone to jail?
Industries had taken oil it didn't pay from federal land. Companies' negligence led to a butane pipeline ruptured and fueled an explosion that killed two teenagers. So this is where we get into, if corporations are persons, then why aren't they in jail?
Shame!
Shame!
On the 20th of September, I received a robotic survey call from the Consumer Energy Alliance. They started with two questions, quote, do you believe gas prices are too high, and quote, do you believe unemployment is too high? Recognizing that this had to be a fake industry push-pull, I answered no to both questions, even though Wall Street has indeed thrown far too many people out of work. I then managed to start recording the rest of this phony so-called survey, microphone to telephone. Turns out the whole survey is about pressuring the Department of State to approve that nasty tar sands oil pipeline that 1,250 people were arrested in front of the White House saying no to. Here's what my microphone got.
Due to U.S. dependence on imports from the Middle East, to build this importing pipeline, TransCanada must receive a permit from the Department of State that will allow it to cross the border from Canada to the U.S. The Department of State is currently soliciting public comments on whether to grant the permit and allow TransCanada to build the pipeline and put thousands of Americans to work. May we have your permission to relay your support for this vital pipeline?
No, you may not. I oppose the pipeline, and I wish the project would be blocked.
Please say yes, no,
no.
Repeat, now.
No.
Would you like more information on
no.
oil and gas production and the jobs that it can create?
No.
Are you male?
Yes.
Are you 50 years of age or older?
No.
Thank you for your time and views. This survey was conducted by the Consumer Energy Alliance. Goodbye. 7-1.
I should have gotten the recording more quickly.
It looks to me like the Consumer Energy Alliance is desperate to keep alive our bad romance with fossil fuels and dirty oil. No, I wasn't going to let them falsely tell the Department of State that I support the filthy Alberta tar sands mining. I'd rather see gasoline cost $10 a gallon than support a pipeline whose contributions to global warming is going to flood every coastal city, including mine.
A week after a brutal police crackdown, indigenous activists in Bolivia restarted their long march to protest the construction of a road through the Isaboro Sucre National Park and indigenous territory. In late September, 500 Bolivian police swooped down to break up the month-long march in the town of Yocumo. TV crews filmed dramatic images of women with their hands tied and tape across their mouths. The crackdown initiated a political crisis for Bolivian President Evo Morales, the South American country's first indigenous leader. Giant protests in La Paz and other big cities broke out to denounce police violence. Morales quickly suspended the construction of the road financed by Brazil, and the defense and interior ministers resigned. After the bloody incident, Morales, who announced his support for the road in 2010, issued a statement declaring, "I could never order such violence as seen by the Bolivian people." He then called for a local referendum to decide the fate of the controversial road. The road, which would connect Brazil's Atlantic coast to the Pacific coast in Peru, will cut through over 1 million hectares of national park and indigenous land in Bolivia. The clampdown on illegal immigration has become a huge global profit opportunity for private prison and security corporations. Governments in the United States, England, and Australia have relied heavily on these companies to detain growing numbers of undocumented immigrants. According to the New York Times, a growing list of firms, including Florida-based Geo Group, G4S, an Anglo-Dutch security company, and Serco, have won lucrative detention contracts but have a poor record on respecting the rights of detainees. Geo Group was found to have mistreated children. G4S was discovered to have abused detainees in solitary confinement. Serco has a record of dangerous overcrowding, ill-trained employees, and it has not hired adequate staff to monitor detainees. In the United States, for-profit prison corporations handle over 200,000 immigrant detainees a year, compared to only 8% of the state and federal inmate population. But immigrant rights and community activists are now pushing back against the aggressive marketing by for-profit detention centers. A new for-profit prison divestment campaign was launched in 2010, targeting big investors in Geo Group and the Corrections Corporation of America, or CCA. The campaign, led by Enlace Institute, a coalition of 21 worker and community groups in the United States and Mexico, convinced a New York hedge fund, Pershing Square Capital Management, to sell its shares of CCA. Other large investors like Wells Fargo, Fidelity Investments, and BlackRock continue to maintain big stakes in for-profit prison companies.
This week, 4,200 inmates in California prisons are on hunger strike, many in solidarity with prisoners at the Pelican Bay Super Maximum Security Facility. Prisoners at Pelican Bay conducted an earlier hunger strike over the summer, but called it off when they believed prison officials would grant some of their demands. Their demands included ending group punishment and administrative abuse, abolishing the debriefing policy which pressures inmates to provide information on the gang status of fellow inmates, ending long-term solitary confinement, providing adequate and nutritious food, and offering constructive programming and privileges for those held indefinitely in supermax custody. When it became apparent that prison officials would not enact substantive changes, prisoners began a second hunger strike on September 29th and were joined by inmates at other state prisons across California through a method of communication supporters on the outside either don't know or aren't talking about. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Amy Fettig, senior staff counsel with the American Civil Liberties Union's National Prison Project. She discusses the inhumane conditions at Pelican Bay with a focus on solitary confinement, considered by Amnesty International and other groups to be a form of torture.
This protest arises from a number of things, but its chief concern is extended solitary confinement for not months, not years, but sometimes decades, for men that are almost completely isolated from other human beings, who are kept in almost complete idleness, so they have nothing to do, nothing to fill their time, and have no way to actually get out of the conditions that they are subject to. They can't earn their way out. They're basically trapped in this limbo state with no means to solve their problems other than to try to get the world to pay a greater attention by starving themselves.
Is this how all of them are treated in the Supermax? I remember when the Supermax prisons came online a couple of decades ago, that was one of their defining characteristics, right? The prisoners are kept in solitary confinement just about all the time?
Yes, yeah. For on average, 24 hours a day of complete social isolation. This means you don't get to interact with other human beings. You have your meals in your cell. You rarely ever leave your cell. You rarely have access to visiting anyone. And when you go outside for what may be called recreation, you are in a cage by yourself. So that is a level of isolation that is almost impossible for your average American to even imagine.
Amnesty International and many other groups, including mental health professionals, have defined this as torture.
Yes, as has bodies in the United Nations. In fact, all the research that has been done for years and decades has found that these types of conditions impact human beings in extreme ways. For folks who have mental illness to begin with, this will no doubt, being subject to these conditions, cause that individual to become sicker and sicker. But conditions of extreme isolation also have incredible impacts on folks who came into the system without mental illness. It literally makes you mentally ill. So there are some real questions about subjecting individuals to this type of isolation, especially when we're looking not at days or months, but years and even decades.
You were talking about them starving themselves to death, but I'm sure before things got that far, they would be force-fed, no? Did that happen in the first round of the hunger strike earlier this year?
You know, I'm not aware if it got that far in the last round. Certainly it went on. The initial round was 3 weeks, and the policy would be to force feed an individual before he or she actually expired. However, you get to a real state of a degradation in your health when you're talking about starving yourself for such a long period of time. So these are very risky things to do. They're causing a great deal of harm. But I think you have to look at what the options are for these prisoners, especially now when they, you know, back in July, they reached out to prison officials, they went on strike. It looked like there would be some real negotiations. And what we can see from this next strike is that the prisoners really felt that they weren't being listened to, they weren't being dealt with fairly, and that they had no other options.
Amy Fettig, has Governor Jerry Brown weighed in on this at all? In his first stint as governor in the 1970s, he was avowedly liberal with a spiritual streak. It seems like these conditions wouldn't sit well with him.
I don't know that he has expressed an opinion, quite frankly, but I would hope, as the leader of the state and someone who is currently engaged in prison reform, given the problems that are now endemic in the California system, that he would take a real interest in this, because it's a red flag. It should tell all officials in California that there's something seriously wrong in their prisons and that they need to take some action.
Pelican Bay is a supermax, but the hunger strike has spread to other facilities that are not supermax. If someone isn't already in isolation and starts resisting state authority by going on a hunger strike, are they then put into isolation?
My understanding is that prison officials are now saying that they are going to crack down on the hunger strikers, regardless of whether or not they're in Pelican Bay or another facility, that essentially they're going to get tough now. And I would say this is exactly the wrong reaction to have. Rather than sitting down and engaging in good faith negotiations and realizing that thousands of prisoners don't start starving themselves to death for no reason, that this is the time to take some serious action and reflect on their policies and procedures here, rather than burying their head in the sand yet further. They need to change the way they do business. And frankly, other states already have. Using long-term isolation has unfortunately become a pervasive practice in this country. However, increasingly states are recognizing that not only does it yield bad results, because it has detrimental psychological impacts on people. When they're released to the community, they have higher recidivism rates. And quite frankly, it costs 200% to 300% more to hold people in these types of prisons. So it's really a lose-lose. And what we're seeing in places like Mississippi and Colorado, the state of Maine, New Mexico, is that state legislators are taking a second look at what has been happening in corrections, because it's costing taxpayers millions and millions of dollars, and it's producing lousy results. And on top of that, it's inhumane.
That was Amy Fettig of the ACLU's National Prison Project. For more information on the California prisoner hunger strike and a petition calling for an end to extended solitary confinement, visit our website at btlonline.org. Despite an international campaign and petition drive that collected nearly 1 million signatures to stop his execution, 41-year-old Troy Davis was put to death by lethal injection in a Georgia prison on September 21st. In the weeks before the execution, Amnesty International, which has long campaigned against the death penalty, helped organize 300 vigils and other events in an attempt to pressure Georgia state authorities to commute Troy Davis's death sentence. Although the campaign did not succeed, opponents of capital punishment were heartened by the widespread public attention focused on grave questions surrounding the guilt of Troy Davis. His supporters maintain that there was no physical evidence linking Davis to the 1989 murder of Savannah police officer Mark McPhail. The guilty verdict that put Davis on death row in 1991 was the subject of more uncertainty after 7 of 9 witnesses who testified that Davis was the killer recanted their testimony, declaring that they were pressured by law enforcement to wrongly identify Davis. Your reporter spoke with Richard Dieter, executive director of the Death Penalty Information Center, whose organization provides analysis and information on issues relating to capital punishment. Here he explains why he believes that the national debate and protests that focused on opposition to the execution of Troy Davis could strengthen the movement to abolish the death penalty in the U.S.
Well, I've been in my job here at the Death Penalty Information Center since 1992. Before then, I worked on the death penalty in other places, and this was the largest and most deeply felt reaction to an execution that I have seen in that time. You know, I was in Washington that evening. People were demonstrating in front of the White House and at the Supreme Court at the same time. Students were coming out of universities onto the streets. It was quite amazing. Of course, there were bigger demonstrations in Georgia, in Atlanta, and at the prison. And we were hearing from people in London and Paris, what can we do? That sort of thing all day long. We had calls. We really don't know what people can do. That's sort of, as I say, our role is more informational. But, you know, it was that frustration, I think, that people felt that something was approaching that was wrong, and they didn't know what to do. They felt there ought to be something that a society like ours can do to stop it, and it wasn't stopped. And so, you know, it was an amazing example or display that the death penalty is got a lot of people who are objecting to it, either in theory or, you know, in principle, or at least for this case. You know, I think it was just a large combination of people. It wasn't, everybody wasn't saying the same thing. There were people saying this execution should be stopped, or people are saying the death penalty was wrong. You know, they're coming at it from different perspectives, but it really touched a chord, and I think we're going to see some changes because of it.
So what changes do you think are likely to occur as a result of the national debate, the dialogue, the media focus on the protests and the questions that revolved around Troy Davis's guilt at the time of his execution?
We have a long tradition in our country of proof beyond a reasonable doubt at trial, and that's the way it was in the Troy Davis case. But after trial, that's not the standard anymore. The assumption is you've been found guilty. And you've got to really mount a high wall to overturn that. And Troy Davis's lawyers and supporters, I think, were able to show that there was doubt, certainly reasonable doubt, but that wasn't enough to stop the execution. And that's where I think people felt frustrated. So our system has a hole in it, or the death penalty is not fitting. And you know, one solution would be just not to have the death penalty. Short of that, I think there has to be some standard, whether it be that courts would be mandated by a change in the law, that if there's reasonable doubt, you know, executions cannot go forward and sentences will be reduced, or that the standard for getting the death penalty at the original trial will have to be even higher than it is now, which is the regular beyond a reasonable doubt. So It's really actually not that easy to say what the changes are, but certainly people want something changed, and if the death penalty can't be made to fit within our system, then maybe the death penalty is going to be stopped.
Public opinion in this country has been fairly consistent in its support of the death penalty, but there was a point during a recent Republican presidential candidate debate when the moderator asked Governor Rick Perry about his record number of execution orders. I believe it exceeded 230 during his time as governor, and the audience exploded in cheers. It brought up a lot of questions about the ugly side of America, where there's some kind of cheerleading for death among certain people of a political persuasion. Where do you see public opinion headed in terms of the death penalty? Is the audience during that debate representative of America as a whole?
No, I don't think so. I don't think that I would even say they were representative of a clamor for death. I think that was a purely a political moment at which their coach, their player, was being challenged, and they rose up in support. And the death penalty is mostly symbolic. It's mostly political. in this country. It has very little to do with the criminal justice system or a rational way of punishing. You know, the numbers just don't bear it out. Most of the countries in the world are now doing away with the death penalty. A quarter or a third of our states don't have it at all. And matter of fact, almost all our states rarely use it. So we're moving that way, despite the cheers. That's my belief.
That was Richard Dieter, Executive Director of the Death Penalty Information Center. Learn more about the debate on capital punishment by visiting our website at btlonline.org.